become a member of the Movie Geeks United family. Join us on Twitter at twitter.com/moviegeeksunite, Facebook at facebook.com/moviegeeksunited. Subscribe to us through iTunes. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/moviegeeksunited. You can also access our entire archive of content, including over 700 filmmaker interviews, at blogtalkradio.com/moviegeeksunited or at our official website at moviegeeksunited.net.
I have this feeling about Dorothy. She's going to be a big star.
They're going to give me $10,000 for having my picture taken.
Dorothy is every man's fantasy.
Sit down.
Dorothy, you just can't let him do this to you.
You want her, pal? You can have her. But you're going to have to pay.
Star 80, rated R.
Welcome to the Movie Geeks United 30th Anniversary Tribute to Bob Fosse's staggering film, Star 80. Star 80 was released in the U.S. on November 10th, 1983. It was Bob Fosse's final film. In a far too brief film career that included classics like Cabaret, Lenny, and All That Jazz, Star 80 tells the story of Playboy playmate Dorothy Stratton and her abusive, controlling, and ultimately deadly relationship with Paul Snyder. The film stars Mariel Hemingway and Eric Roberts in one of the defining performances of that decade. To celebrate the film tonight, we speak with legendary editor Alan Heim. In addition to Star 80, Mr. Heim collaborated with Bob Fosse on the films All That Jazz and Lenny. Further examples of his genius work can be found in movies as varied as Network, She's Having a Baby, Quick Change, Funny Farm, and American History X. If I'm not mistaken, you started in sound editing and you kind of graduated into picture editing. And I'm curious, what was it about editing that fit your temperament?
Ha! Interesting question. Okay, I actually went to City College Film School, which was a very small film school at the time. And I think it was even before NYU, perhaps. What happened was I took an editing course, and I was the only student in the day session, so I had to take my course at night. And I worked with a partner, and we used pre-shot material that was very old. And we made a film that was different than anybody else's by editing. And I got intrigued by the whole thing. I mean, that you could take this material and work it and shape it. So I liked it. And then when I was in the Army, I was actually stationed at the Army Pictorial Center in Queens, the old Astoria Studios, Paramount Astoria Studios. And I was taught to be a music editor. And when I got out of the Army, it seemed to be a way to go. You know, just edit music and sound effects, and it was easy for me. So I had a good time doing it for a while. Then I got very bored, and I was about to apprentice myself to a woman so that I could learn a woman editor, so that I could become a picture editor. When Sidney Lumet offered me a chance to edit a film of his, So I did.
Wow. When you think about the qualities that an editor must have, I mean, I'm thinking you do have to be meticulous and patient and open to different points of view, but also you have to have a strong sense of story. I mean, did you always feel that you had a good sense for storytelling?
Yes, I always did. I think When I lecture on occasion, I really tell people it's not so important to look at movies, but read books, look at plays, go to art galleries, just expand your mind and look at other things. So you learn visual stuff and you learn dramatic things, you learn how to tell a story, and it all applies. I mean, you take everything you've learned in your life and put it into a project each time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I want to get into the work you did with Mr. Fosse, but I have one quick question about Network. Sure. That has always fascinated me, because I recall Mr. Lumet talking about the actual look of Network gradually becoming more and more TV-like as the film progressed. Was that something that also translated into the cutting of the film?
Not particularly. You know, the film was a brilliantly written script by Paddy Chayefsky, and Sidney was a director who really knew what he wanted, so that he didn't shoot a lot of material, but what he did, and particularly in that movie, it was choice material. I mean, you had wonderful performances, great words for the actors to say, and I don't know if that's really the case, that we got more and more television-ish as we went along. Sidney might have thought so. We never discussed it. And I just treated the material the way I felt it should be treated, and we really didn't have many disagreements on that. It was oddly enough, one of the easiest films and best films I've ever worked on. But it didn't take a lot of time, and you know, we were pretty much ready to give it to sound editors after about 2 weeks of polishing up my version, and very little was done from my version to the final version.
Wow.
Yeah, it was camera ready. It was editor ready, that movie.
I would imagine so. When you're dealing with a piece of material as brilliantly written as that one, and the performances across the board were just superlative.
Yeah.
I would imagine it was a dream to cut.
It was a dream. It was absolutely perfect. And as I say, it almost tumbled out of my moviola and right into the screen. There was very little. We had one scene that was in what I thought was the wrong script order. The scene with Beatrice Straight when she confronts her husband with his infidelity. Or actually, he tells her. And that was that used to come after the scene with, I always get this backwards, but it came after the scene with Faye Dunaway on the beach, that kind of ridiculous love scene where she's only talking about television and he's just trying to make love.
Mm-hmm.
And it was then followed by the scene with the wife, as I remember it. But I kept saying the scene with the wife should come first and then the scene, because once you see him with Faye Dunaway in that scene on the beach, you realize what a wonderful woman his wife is. And even lust was not enough to make him fall that way. And anyway, the producer came in one day, Dan Melnick, and came in on a Friday, and we looked at the movie, and he liked it very much. And on Monday morning, I got a call from Howard Gottfried, who was the line producer of the movie, and he said, "Alan," and he sang my name a little bit. So, you know, when somebody's singing your name, he said, "You know, Danny came up with this great idea, and he suggested transposing the scenes," which I had wanted to do, and then nobody would let me do it. They wanted to drop the scene, let's say, with Beatrice Straight. And I kept saying, "No, this must stay in the movie. We have to move it around." And nobody wanted to take the time to actually do it. Sidney was always very impatient in the cutting room. So we did it, and it stayed, and she won an Academy Award for the 2.5-minute scene that we had there.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, and I felt just great. And, you know, it's funny. I haven't looked at it in a while, and I don't remember the exact order, but whatever it was in the script the other way. But Patty had written such a tight script, and it was just so brilliant, and it was so prescient, because it applies to today just as much as it did 35 years ago.
When did you first meet Mr. Fosse on Liza with a Z?
Yes. That was kind of another lucky break. I was unemployed, living in New York, of course, and I got a call from a producer named Kenny Utt, whom I had worked with in television when I was a sound effects editor. And I think Kenny had gone to a couple of other editors who weren't available, And when he realized I had a music background and sound effects background, he thought Fosse and I might get along. And imagine my surprise when we did. I was dazzled by the man when I first met him. Absolutely astounded. And now that I went to meet him at Broadway Art Studio, which was later replicated and all that jazz, right down to the plumbing. But I walked up there, and I had not seen Cabaret. My wife at the time had seen it and said, "You got to go see this movie." And ironically, I said, "Yeah, well, you know, I don't really like movie musicals." And she said, "You got to go see this. It's not a movie musical." So I met with Bob, and all these dancers were flying around the room rehearsing Liza with a Z. And Bob was, I don't think he was too impressed. I'm not a musician, and I can't read music, but I've been a music editor, or have been, you know, all my life, and I've got a very good ear, good sense of rhythm. And he hired me. But that afternoon, I called home, and I said, "I'm going to see an afternoon show of Cabaret." It was playing a couple of blocks away at the Ziegfeld. I went to see Cabaret, and then I just waited for him to make a decision to hire me, because, boy, did I want to do that movie. And then I wanted to work with this man. It's, you know, you don't get too many chances to work with what I think is a bona fide genius. And that worked out. I mean, not enough, because Bob always, we did, what, three movies and one television show and a couple of commercials in the 15 years we worked together, which you cannot make a living on, but I've been dining out on it for a long time, so what the heck.
Mm-hmm. What was his genius?
He was able to extract the best out of everybody he worked with. Actors, technicians, me. He just made you want to, what's the word, satisfy him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was incredibly smart. And I think he also, I mean, his angles were different than you expected. When I hired an assistant on All That Jazz, I gave him the script to read, and I said, "Just be prepared that nothing, no close-up you that's indicated in the script, nothing will look exactly like anybody else's." He was very careful in composing. He was very careful in just everything he did. And he worked with great talent. He wanted perfection, and he never relented. I mean, he settled sometimes, but what he had in his mind was what he wanted on the screen. And that's a great thing. So many people today really don't know what they want. You know, they'll shoot it and think, we'll make it in the cutting room. Well, that's a nice idea, but you got to have it on the film at some point before you can make it in the cutting room. And Bob just knew what he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And we eventually, for the most part, got it.
Do you feel, because I've always heard this phrase that films aren't so much completed as they are abandoned.
Yes.
But did you feel that when he completed a film that it was completed to his satisfaction?
Mostly. I mean, if you would, people have asked me, you know, would I do anything else differently in some of the films I worked on? And yeah, I would. I would go back and rework the last musical number in the death of Roy, of Joe. I would go back and rework that. And Bob agreed with me later after the film was finished. Because we added a little bit. Bob wanted to squeeze in every single bit of material.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all good, but it runs a little extra in length and in time. And it needs sort of drag in a couple of places. Yeah, if we had it to go over again, I think we'd go back and still work on it. But it's true, you abandon. You just, at a point, the studio says, "We got to deliver, we got to put it in the theaters, we got to do this," and so you do it. Nothing much has changed as far as that goes. But
the other thing that really impresses me about Mr. Fosse's work is just the incredibly intense amount of passion that I can feel from these films, and how kind of autobiographical they feel, that he's blood, sweat, and tears are all over the screen, especially with something like All That Jazz.
That was his life, though he always got pissed off with me when I said it. He always denied it was autobiographical. That, come on. that was his address on the pill bottles. And half of us in the movie, I exaggerate slightly, but a good number of us in the movie were really the people who we were. I mean, I played the editor, and his stage manager played the stage manager, and then the conductor was his conductor, the rehearsal pianist, the dancers, and so many people had a brush with Bob's life at that point. And it was only at his memorial service that Stuart Ostro, who was a good friend of his, Stuart came over to me and said something that just moved me immensely, that Bob always said I was the guy who edited his life. But he would never admit that in the cutting room, because I kept referring to the character as you, and he would say, no, it's Roy, it's Joe, it's not me.
Do you feel that he used his art as kind of a form of therapy in a way, that he was working out things through his art?
Very possibly. You know, Bob was deeply involved with therapy. It's not a secret. I mean, he and Gwen both had been involved in therapy. They were, I think, major donors to the New York Psychoanalytic Clinic. And he was a brilliant man. I mean, he wasn't just a song and dance guy. He was terrific and smart. And on one level, I mean, Bob's movies all dealt with similar subjects, manipulative men and show business.
Mm-hmm.
And the three movies I did with him, and I don't, Cabaret? Well, I'm not sure about Cabaret, but the other three were all his projects, and all of them dealt with manipulative men. The last film he wanted to do, last time I spoke to him, he was telling me that he wanted to do a film about Walter Winchell, who was certainly a manipulative guy in show business. So I wish he had lived to do that.
I still miss
him every once in a while.
I wanted to tell you, speaking of All That Jazz, that one of my all-time favorite music cues in films is Perfect Day, Harry Nilsson from...
Oh, yes.
That kind of semi-seduction scene in All That Jazz. It's incredible.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, Bob came up with most of the music, and he worked also with Ralph Burns all the time, both on Broadway shows and in films. And Ralph was a great arranger, you know, back with the Woody Herman Band in the early 40s. A great jazz piano player, and he made a career of doing film music later. And just a perfect, perfect man. I'll tell you an interesting story. I digress a lot, so stop me anytime. But,
no, this is great.
I went up to... I had a couple of commercials that I had edited for Bob, and I wanted to show them to him for the show Dancing. Yeah. No. Gee, you know, I don't remember now. I guess it was for Chicago. So I took him up there and went into the theater, the Schubert Theater, went downstairs and ran into Ralph Burns, who was smoking. Ralph had stopped smoking. He had given up smoking. And I said, how come you're smoking? And he said, I only smoke when I work for Fosse. I mean, it was the same kind of thing. You know, you just have to reach down and pull up what you need. I mean, Ralph was, he had given up every possible addiction in the world, including smoking, years and years ago. And here he was smoking again, but only when he worked for Bob.
When you guys embarked on Star 80, I mean, this is very intense material. Was the structure of the film, with the eyewitness interviews inserted and going back and forth between the murder to the story, was that structure in the script?
Let me tell you where all of this came from a little bit.
Okay.
Well, for one thing, Ralph Burns used to say, With Fosse, you never knew whether you were in real time or flashbacks or flash forwards. It was Fosse time. And that's kind of what it was. But when we did, I'm going to digress again, so here you go. When we did Lenny, we had some structural problems. The script was incredibly complex, involving Lenny's routines and his life. But when we actually got into the cutting room, it kind of sat there, because actors often like to be liked. They want to be liked. And Dustin, who's a terrific actor, he was very young then, but he couldn't get the edge that Bob wanted and that I think was necessary in the performance. And I suggested to Bob that he that we intercut the scenes even more than they had been written. And we did. And suddenly, it gave us a lot more freedom, and it raised Dustin's performance. I think he was nominated for an Academy Award. He hated what we did with the performance. But it really worked very well for the movie, for the character. And, of course, near the end, we give him that six-minute scene on the stage where we don't cut at all for various reasons, which I don't have to get into right now, but we felt he deserved it. He was really so good by the end of the movie that scene, you know, just left him out there, and he carried it. He was great. Mm-hmm. But anyway, we developed some structural stuff in that movie. And then when Bob wrote All That Jazz with Robert Allen Arthur, he wanted to keep the same kind of time, free time going. But by writing it in a way, it almost constrained us. So there were things that we couldn't really do with the flexibility we did in Lenny. And though we were not unhappy with the results, God knows. But when we were finishing All That Jazz, Bob came in one day and he handed me an article from the Village Voice, which I had read before. And it was the article that Star 80 was based on. I forget the author's name. She has a credit on the film based on
Teresa Carpenter.
Teresa Carpenter, good. Yeah. So he said, this is my next movie. And so most of that in my memory, and again, you're talking 30 years ago, but most of that was in the script, more or less. How it was handled and, you know, why you handle it, it becomes sort of the secrets of the cutting room. You know, is the actor good enough or the actress good enough? How do we get around this problem? Because there are always problems when you're putting the movie together. It's never. No matter how strong the writer-director, no matter how brilliant the script, it never, ever comes out exactly the way it was planned. So, anyway, yeah, that's how that came about. And then Bob was really enamored of that idea of moving time, fiddling with time. And, you know, editing is one of the few fields, movies, and one of the few fields we can really do that with an enormous amount of flexibility.
One of the things that I think is so amazing about Star 80 is that, and I'm sure it was the major point of controversy with the film, is that it dares to force an audience to empathize with someone that they would be more comfortable thinking of as a monster.
Exactly.
And Eric Roberts gives one of the great performances of that entire decade for me.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Continue. I'm sorry.
I was just wondering if you felt that Mr. Fosse's attraction to this material was particularly that Paul Snyder character.
I think it was a chance to whack show business. Bob had a love-hate relationship with show business. I mean, he knew every nuance of it, and he loved it. At the same time, it's a very backstabbing and destructive business in a way. So here was a guy who, Paul Snyder, who manipulated not only Dorothy Stratton, but manipulated a whole bunch of people, women mostly, and men. He was a con man and a hustler, and he was, in a way, disgusting, I guess. About a year later, I was sitting with the producer having breakfast, on a film. I had never met the producer before. And he said to me, you know, you really seem like a nice guy. How could you work on such a vile movie? Mm. Well, I never felt it was vile. I felt it was difficult. But it did open an underside of show business in a way. Certainly the people in California hate it. Reviewers hated it. Bob took it very badly when the film came out, and it was pretty much skewered by everybody. But I think it's an absolutely brilliant example of communal filmmaking, as it were. I mean, you had Sven Nykvist shooting it, and it looks great. And you had Bob directing with great performances from most of the people. And it's just, it's also well edited, if I may say so itself. But
it is incredibly well
edited. Without all of the stuff that's going on, I mean, without everybody's contribution, that film would be almost unwatchable if it were not made with such care, with mm-hmm. such love, really. I mean, we had discussions on the end of the film where Paul attempts to rape her three times, and there's a great deal of blood on the wall after the shooting. And we asked Bob, both, you know, Kenny Gott was a producer again by coincidence, and we did ask Bob to tone it down a little, and he didn't want to. Later, we tried in the cutting room to remove one of the rape attempts, and because of the way the film was structured, and I don't remember why, but I couldn't remove one. The thing was, there was so much movement within the frame and within that room that it just didn't make sense to remove one of them, so we didn't. But what you mentioned about people facing themselves, at that time I had a friend who was a bodybuilder and a weightlifter, and actually there were two people involved. Both guys. One was a bodybuilder and weightlifter. The other guy was a dancer and lawyer. And both of these people absolutely hated the movie. Hated it. And I was convinced that they hated it because they saw themselves in the character. It was difficult to work on. I mean, the only other film I've ever had that much difficulty working on physically was The Pawnbroker. As a sound editor, because it was just unrelentingly grim. This film was just good filmmaking, and I was a lot more mature then.
It's brilliant filmmaking. But I wanted to ask you a question or get your impression of something, because Eric Roberts has spoken in many interviews before that one piece of direction that Mr. Fosse gave him, he kind of pulled him aside and he said, "Look, Paul Snyder is who I would be if I wasn't a success."
Yeah. Yeah, I think Bob said that to me once when we were talking about the character. I seem to remember he said that, or maybe I heard it from Eric. I don't remember. But yeah, I mean, you know, you have a small time, I don't know, Bob, for all of his incredible talent and his charm, and he was pretty insecure. I mean, one of the things he said to me, and it's a cliche, but it was never a joke. He always said, "Get your next job before this film comes out." And, you know, I think he really meant it. Not only for me, but for him. Go ahead.
When you was there a lot of extra footage when you worked on Fosse's films? Or, I mean, was it a real process to get it really tight and close to the bone when you edited it?
Well, Jazz was, because we had so much excess material due to the dance coverage. I don't think Star 80 was, but I don't remember that much. There were... I don't remember. I mean, Bob would direct for performance, and when he got a good performance, he would be pretty happy with it. What would happen is he would come into the cutting room and sit with me, and we'd look at a scene and look at it and talk about it and talk, you know, whatever my version was, and then we'd start making it better. And we wouldn't move on until we were happy with that particular scene. And sometimes it took a while, and sometimes, you know, it happened quickly. But it was for both of us. You know, we wanted the film to be good and to progress in a linear fashion. Then, of course, you go back and look at the whole thing and see where the mistakes are. But Sidney Lumet used to say that he never liked to look at anything that wasn't at least a half hour of material at a time, half hour of material in order. Mm. And it's a luxury that you rarely have on a movie, but we had it. We did it. All three films I did with Bob, we worked from the beginning right to the end and just dug in. They took a long time. Mm. I mean, I think it was 11 months on Star 80 and 14 months on All That Jazz.
Wow, wow.
Well, I've worked on much, much inferior materials almost. So, yeah.
But I would imagine that you knew that you were working with, for lack of a better word, dangerous material. And I'm curious, did you screen the movie to get reactions prior to release at all? Or?
No. You know, in those days, part of the freedom of working in New York City was that the studios really didn't bother you.
Mm.
And I don't believe we ever had a test screening of Star 80. What we did do, and the same with All That Jazz, Bob was pretty much left alone. Let's see, let me try to remember. We showed Lenny to David Picker, who was the producer, at one point near the end. And we also screened for friends, Bob's friends, my friends, whoever we wanted to invite, usually not the actors. But, and people not particularly connected with the movie. And then we'd have sort of a Q&A, but it wasn't a big screening. It was a few people. And we'd talk, and then people would call and give us notes, and we'd do them or not do them. It was a great freedom. It was unbelievable. And you don't do that anymore. Everything gets tested now, and everything gets homogenized, which is one of the reasons that films don't have the integrity they used to have.
I agree.
So I
agree.
I believe.
You had to have been, you and Mr. Fosse had to have been kind of heartbroken by the initial reception to Star 80.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. I was sent to a screening at Lincoln Center because Bob couldn't go. They wanted somebody from the film to talk about it, I guess. Bob couldn't go, and the producer, Kenny Utt, couldn't go, so they asked me if I would go. And I was sitting in the very back of the audience, and near the end, about the time the shotgun comes out, this was an audience of mostly Lincoln Center Film Club or something like that. I don't know what it's called now, but people who paid a premium, like a couple $100 to see movies before they were released, mm-hmm. and talk to the filmmakers. Well, the whole row in front of me, when the shotgun came out, the entire row got up, shielded their eyes from the screen, and walked out of the theater. And this was right in front of me. And I'm thinking, oh, well, at least we reached them. Mm-hmm. Which is something I learned from Fosse in the heart surgery sequence and all that jazz. You know, people are very scared by, you know, you can watch a horror film, you can watch Texas Chainsaw Massacre and not have the same involvement. But when you watch a real heart surgery, or you watch what was, in point of fact, a real murderer, as best as can be, you know, as best as can be reassembled from the evidence, when you watch that, and it has a real visceral effect on you, very different than the fakery of a horror movie. It's too real, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe, and then Bob believed, you know, you just do the movie that you feel you have to make and trust the audience to get it.
And wasn't that last segment, wasn't that actually shot in the real apartment?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. a lot of it was, Bob was a great one for shooting on locations, so, I mean on real locations, so a lot of it was shot, yeah, we were in Vancouver for quite some time shooting, then we came to Hollywood and shot most of the rest of the movie in Hollywood, an experience that Bob never particularly enjoyed, but, you know, there we were, and then we came back to New York to finish it, so, yeah, that was in the apartment. It was located on the other side, right next to the freeway. I mean, the film opens up with that rather odd buzzing noise.
Uh-huh.
And the lights whipping by, and you don't quite know what it is. And then eventually you realize it's a freeway. And they lived right across from the freeway, right next to the freeway. A lot of people in California do, as you might know.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, it was close to the bone. You also, when you're dealing with real people, you keep meeting people who knew them. And they tell you things, you know, that you're doing it wrong or stuff like that. But to go back to Star 80, that's where we are, I guess. We were very careful with the Peter Bogdanovich character and also with the Hugh Hefner character. I think Bob wanted to make both of them last year, but we couldn't. We were terribly afraid to be sued. And we were also afraid that the family would get involved. There was money put aside, I know, to deal with lawsuits. I don't know how much, and I don't know if it ever got touched. But
I didn't find either portrait of Hefner or Bogdanovich, whose character name was obviously changed. I did not find either of them offensive in any way.
No. Well,
and yet they were.
The Hefner character is a little smarmy.
Uh-huh.
And I think the Bogdanovich character, it's just the nature of, I mean, everybody sort of knew what had been happening with Bogdanovich and her. So, you know, the fact that it's out there at all is disturbing to anybody, I think. And it was disturbing to them. So we were very careful. We really tried to not make them too manipulative, too offensive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Cliff Robertson was terrific. And again, you know, great performances. So yeah, we were a little careful. But that was in the writing almost as much as in the editing. We walked on eggs quite a bit. I think this film is really an important film, and I wish more people had seen it, and I wish more people would see it, even now.
Do you feel when did you start to feel that the tide of public opinion had turned on the movie from insulted to kind of seeing the movie for how great it was, to admiration?
Oh, I don't pay attention to that. You know, the pain hurt at first. I mean, it hurt Bob a lot more than it hurt me. It really threw him into a funk. And we saw each other a couple of times after that. He was very disturbed by that, knowing full well that we were risking that, or he was risking that. But, you know, history just moves on, and I just wanted to make a good movie, and I think I took part in making a good movie. If it takes a while for the audience to come along, that's unfortunate. But, you know, there you are. You've got the product. It's out there. And now with DVDs, anybody can watch it.
Mm-hmm.
I get a lot of comments from people who are really amazed by the movie after, you know, so many years.
When you think about Mr. Fosse, what do you miss most about him?
Ha! Interesting question. I miss his talent. I mean, I miss the ability to look forward to working with a guy like him again. I've done a few films for Nick Cassavetes, and I always tell Nick that he is, apart from Fosse, my favorite filmmaker, because he too just wants to make the best movie humanly possible, and he doesn't want to compromise. And that's what I loved about Bob. He was uncompromising. He was quite demanding, but he was civilized almost all the way through. You know, he never demeaned anybody. Privately, we'd have a joke or two occasionally about performance or about something else in the movie. But he was just a really, for me, I mean, he was always a decent human being and an incredible talent. So you don't get too many of those.
I so appreciate you giving me your time tonight. It's been such an honor to talk to you. Anytime.
Oh, thank you.
Anytime that you'd like to talk in the future and come back on the show, I'd love to have you.
Oh, very nice. Well, anytime you want to exhume one of the movies I worked on that I think is wonderful, I'd like to talk about it also. I mean, I think this is an important thing you're doing to get this film out there. Can you answer a question for me?
Absolutely.
You talked about people realizing, you know, later that the audience came around to this movie. But give me more about that, because I, as I say, I don't really follow this.
Have
a historical.
When that movie came out, I mean, I was first of all, I was too young to see it when it first came out. But I was aware of the critical bashing that it took. And I knew that it was a hot potato, that movie, and it stirred up a lot of venom. But I can tell you without a doubt, I talk about Star 80 a lot, and I talk about Mr. Roberts' work and Mr. Fosse's work in it. And across the board, we get correspondences or comments from our listeners that say this is one of the great unsung films of this decade. Of the 80s. I think it's very widespread, particularly amongst people my age, maybe 30s, 40s, people that feel this is one of those great movies that more people should be talking about.
Oh, yeah, that makes me feel really so good. Because I agree. I mean, it's just one of those disappeared movies, and I'm glad that people are watching it and that people, that you're bringing it out again for folks, so that's great.
Well, I don't know if it's out of print, the DVD, as you said, but Warner Brothers is usually fairly good at pressing Blu-rays of their back catalog.
Right.
So I sure hope that happens sometime soon.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, they still haven't done a Blu-ray of Jazz, but that's not one of their movies. But nobody's done a Blu-ray of Jazz, which kind of surprises me.
Yeah, me too. But me too.
I'm sure they will. Anyway, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Me too. Your work is much loved, and we appreciate you very much.
Oh, thanks. It's very moving.